Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, there has been a perturbation in the force, as they say, Star Wars. Tucker Carlson, a valued colleague in this line of work, has been removed by Fox News from his perch as the anchor of its evening weekday programming. For reasons that are not entirely clear as we speak, but the implications of it are pretty clear and likely to really be devastating to those of us who looked to Tucker for clarity and courage about many of the most important topics of our day. One needn't have agreed with him on everything he said or espoused, and I didn't, to recognize that his voice was incredibly important, not just for conservatives, but for, well, patriots, yes, but I think for the country as a whole. And to talk a little bit about the implications of his departure from that platform, at least, I'm very pleased to have with us a man who has been a leader of the conservative movement, among other things. His name is Bill Walton, a featured regular of our program, I'm very pleased to say, and the host of his own, The Bill Walton Show, who, among other careers, has been a master of the universe on Wall Street. But I'm particularly appreciative of the time he spent leading an organization of which I'm proud to be a member, the Council for National Policy. And as a result, a man with his finger very much on the pulse of thinking of conservatives and, yes, others who love our country. Bill Walton, welcome back to Securing America. Always good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, great talking with you.
So let's talk a little bit about what has happened here and what you think it portends.
I think it's hard to overstate the impact that it looks like Rupert Murdoch has on removing Tucker Carlson from a primetime show, 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, five nights a week. It's as if Rush Limbaugh had been snatched out of his talk radio in the prime of his career. And, you know, my belief about Tucker is, as you point out, we don't agree with him about everything, but I agree with him about most everything. And, you know, he was really a thorn in the side of the establishment, the elite, the globalists, obviously the Biden administration. And
I'd say the Republican establishment as well. He seemed to be pretty set on, among others, calling out Mitch McConnell.
Well, you've got to wonder about the impact of Paul Ryan on this decision.
Absolutely.
Paul's on the board of Fox News Corp. And
former Speaker of the House of Representatives. Doctor.
Yeah, you're right, Frank. I mean, the Republican Party, quote, leadership, at least in the Senate side in particular, is hardly friends of freedom and what Tucker was saying. And, you know, they've silenced Tucker's voice. And I guess it came down to, as I understand it, they had this big settlement close to $1 billion with Dominion, the voting machine company, which some people believe, I believe, is in part owned by the Chinese Communist Party. Anyway, they lost that lawsuit, and Tucker was going to do a show on Monday night touching on this issue, and I think I don't know exactly what the show was going to be. Anyway, the Fox powers that be came in and said, well, look, from here on out, we're going to have to start letting you know what you can say and what you can't say. My understanding, he said, that's not acceptable, and he's gone. Now, he'll come back on another platform, but it's tough to find a soapbox as powerful and as easy to access as Fox News is.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I have the feeling that wherever he winds up is going to become, I have the feeling that wherever Tucker Carlson next appears is going to turn out to be a pretty popular platform. And I hope that that voice will not be still. You know, one of the things, Bill, and I just have to say this because it's so stunning to me, that I think may have featured in that last show, as it would have been, I guess, was the rebuttal to some of the things that have been said, among other people, by 60 Minutes, most recently, of Ray Epps and his role in this January 6th episode. Tucker, of course, was the guy that Kevin McCarthy, the current Speaker of the House, gave enormous quantities of video to sort of do an independent look at what actually went on that day in Capitol Hill. And Ray Epps was at the heart of it, obviously, and it was bizarre that 60 Minutes did this, as did the New York Times, this incredible, you know, whitewash of the guy and his role in that affair.
Let's do a silver lining, Frank. This could be the death knell of Fox News as the place where conservatives, libertarians, like-minded people go to get their news. And there is an opportunity here to go set up. But there are other platforms that already exist with, off cable. And I think this may be a chance to get conservatives, particularly older conservatives, to start getting their news elsewhere. If that happens, that's a good thing. And I hope that Tucker is right at the epicenter of it.
Well, I have the feeling he will be. And I very much hope that our platform, Real America's Voice, will be among those.
I forgot the most important platform, Frank.
it's pretty important to this program,
I think, for sure. You and I had a, let's go see Tucker. Let's go visit him in Florida. Let's start our recruiting trip.
There's a plan. I suspect others are beating a path to his door. Bill, I want to talk to you about a bunch of other things as well, of course. One of the things that Tucker actually was seized with, as are we, is the prospect that the asymmetric warfare that the Chinese Communist Party has been engaged in for decades now is making real headway on one particular line of attack that it has been focused on, I think it's fair to say, for a very long time with others, notably the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And now others. And that is toppling the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. And I know you've expressed skepticism about the feasibility of doing that in the near term. And yet there does seem to be steady progress being made even now. But talk us through how you see that playing out, Bill. Is it a problem over the longer term for sure? And maybe even on an accelerating basis?
Well, let's do history. Every empire sees its hegemony disappear. I mean, look at the British pound after World War I. They lost their role in reserve currency, certainly after World War II.
Two, for sure, yeah.
And, they hung on between the wars, but it was clear the United States was the dominant coming power. And the problem that the Southern Hemisphere, they're now almost wholly aligned with China. China's been investing in Africa and South America for decades now. And, you know, they've got most of the leaders of those countries in effect on their payroll. And this is the fallout, I believe, of the Biden's administration's insane focus on trying to take out Putin through their proxy war in Ukraine, and in the process wrecking Ukraine, killing hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians, and using the currency, the dollar, and sanctions as one of the weapons, since we won't commit our own forces, we'll just commit young men and women from Ukraine. And the rest of the countries around the world are looking at this use of the dollar as a weapon, and they're gathering together virtually every other country outside the European bloc and saying, we need an alternative. Well, Macron, well, you know, he's a separate,
maybe an outlier at the moment, but I think he's driving things in that direction of accommodating China.
But the Syria, you know, the part that really matters is that the dollar's status as a world currency. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is that there are really two big picture things about the dollar. One,
we can't convert either of them right this second. We're going to have to pause. Hold on, folks. You're going to find about those two big things from Bill Holton on the other side of this. Ran the clock out.
Right. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. America's bid to return human beings to the moon was just set back by the catastrophic loss during launch of the spacecraft Elon Musk's SpaceX built for the purpose. Worse yet, it appears increasingly possible that by the time we're ready to go back there, the Chinese Communist Party will have declared the place off limits and be able to enforce it. The Chinese Communists recently announced they are planning moon missions that will attempt to turn lunar dirt into bricks with which structures can be efficiently and inexpensively built. Inevitably, those will include fortifications. Chinese panoramic mapping of Mars and growing capabilities to neutralize other satellites offer further indications of the scope of what is at best Beijing's inherently dual-use space program. At worst, it is a fully militarized one with some civilian applications. Houston, we have a problem. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and Bill Walton is in the house, I'm pleased to say, virtually. We're always delighted to catch up with him, but especially at a moment when there is still further evidence that the Chinese Communist Party and its friends are making headway in laying siege to the reserve status, reserve currency status, that is, of the U.S. dollar. And Bill, you were just about to explain what are the two big things that are going to determine whether they're succeeding. So hit it.
Well, when we talk about the dollar, it's something people should understand. There's both its role as a reserve currency and then its role in global international trade. And its share of reserve currency has been falling from 70%, and I think it to 50% something, maybe 55%. And then just in the last year, because of the impact of the Ukraine sanctions and using dollars as a weapon, I think it's fallen all the way, inflation adjusted, 45%, a precipitous decline. But the other role the dollar plays is in world trade. And it's got an 85, 90% share of world trade because it's such a deep market, so liquid. And if you're a practical business person, you're not only making your trades, but you're hedging it, and you're hedging your trades in dollars. So, the thing that protects the dollar is that to have it lose its status is you need to have a viable alternative. And the European nations with the euro, I mean, their inflation is higher than ours. Their debt as a percentage of GDP is higher than ours, and they've just been a mess in terms of economic policy. Japan, of course, at one point 20, 30 years ago, might have played that role, no longer. And that brings us, of course, to China. And, of course, Chinese currency is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And on top of that, the Chinese economy is no longer that robust. They've had their own debt bubble. They've had a real estate bust. And they've made themselves, with Xi's lockdowns, the COVID lockdowns, they've made themselves almost uninvestable. And so in terms of attracting hard money global investors who want to protect their capital, that you do not go to China.
And yet, Bill, I just have to ask you, you've got Brazil now, and we're going to come back to this point about the inroads that the Chinese Communist Party has been making in the global South, as it's being called. You have Saudi Arabia. You have the Russians all now allowing their purchases of energy to be denominated in the yuan. Is that not evidence of it becoming a viable alternative currency, notwithstanding the fact, as you say, that it's subject to manipulation by the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, we shall see. I mean, the making China and Brazil and Saudi Arabia making common cause and having a common monetary policy, I think the odds of that happening are remote. But you can't say it wouldn't ever happen. I mean, if we continue to mismanage the U.S. economy the way we have and mismanage our relationships with countries around the world, it could happen. I mean, certainly,
and,
if we
and,
did
a, and not least undermine the value of the dollar by running the printing presses.
If we get a Biden or a Biden proxy second term, I think we're talking 4 or 5 years. If we get somebody who's a strong, and it will be a Republican, a strong Republican president who can, right the ship, if you will, although there's a lot to be fixed right now, that's going to stave off the, I think, the inevitable decline of the dollar.
Well, 4 or 5 years sounds awfully long to me, given the acceleration as you've seen.
In money, it's a pretty short time.
Well, yeah, no, I get that. But let me just come back to this, this idea that, it's unlikely that you'll see the Russians and the Saudis and the, the Brazilians making common foreign policy. That certainly seems to be the object of this so-called BRICS cluster. And as I say, they're expanding its membership. It's still, I think, early days in terms of it actually cohering. But Bill, talk a little bit about, for example, Lula da Silva, the Marxist who now is president once again of Brazil, the pilgrimage he made after coming to Washington, to be sure, and then sort of taking it to Joe Biden when he got home on a couple of different fronts, then heading off to China, kowtowing and making very explicit his pursuit of the idea of displacing the dollar as the reserve currency and otherwise throwing in with the CCP. It's his country's most, by far, largest trading partner, speaking of trade. How does that not only exemplify a phenomenon that the Chinese are anxious to foster, but also perhaps accelerate it as well?
Well, Frank, I've got to put on my hat as an investor and say, if I've got investment capital, where do I want to put it? And Brazil under Lula is not a place where you want to put investment capital. I mean, his policies during his last regime were catastrophic, and he shows very little sign of reining those impulses in. And so you've got him out trying to play a role in the world stage, and he's being very effective, I think, near term. But he's got to manage or create conditions for the Brazilian economy to thrive. I'd have to check my numbers, but I think it's about the 11th or 12th largest economy of the world, which makes it a player. But he's got to have a policy, economic policy, that would be attractive to somebody like me who'd be willing to take a chance on investing in Brazil. And right now, those conditions just aren't there.
Okay, but let's talk about this, because it seems has been the case in that part of the global south and elsewhere as well is people saying, well, we'll take the Chinese money. If you're not going to invest, we'll have various kinds of lending as well as investments from China, notably these, I call them payday loans from the Chinese for their Belt and Road Initiative.
Vito Corleone loan.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, just talk us through this, Bill. I mean, is that an alternative? And I gather that we're seeing in a number of places those payday loans not working out,
It's important for us to stop, for me anyway, to stop thinking myopically about the good old United States that used to be the world hegemon. We would be the moral force in the world and the economic force to set arrangements. That's no longer the case. I think we've lost our moral leadership, certainly under Biden. In fact, we had a lot more under Trump, much more. And so we've
despite really, Biden's endless criticisms of how bad that was and how great it's going to be under him,
and how he abandons, look what he did in Afghanistan. He just cut and run. So if you've been aligned with the U.S., you want to be very careful about that. We've always been unreliable, but we're much more unreliable under Biden. And so there's a good reason for these people wanting to do business with each other. Lula has even started saying, well, look, we don't need the United States to broker a deal in Ukraine. We can do that with his group of mediators, China, Brazil, and hold on to your seat, Turkey. And those three countries can go in and start working Russia and Ukraine to try to settle this up.
Another application of this whole BRICS idea.
That's the way they're thinking.
Yeah. But Bill, does China have the wherewithal to replace the U.S. and the West more generally?
In terms of international lending, Frank, if you look at the so-called development loans that are made around the world, the Chinese dominate that. And the international institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, are much, much less important than the direct loans that individual countries have made is much less important. China dominates it. But the thing that's fascinating is the Chinese are hard money lenders. We are payday loan people.
They put the money in,
they expect to get repaid, or they expect some collateral. They expect some a pound
of brush. All that infrastructure that they've built with those payday loans.
Bill,
we're out of time. I got to go. This is a subject to which we will return. Thank you, my friend. As always, great to talk with you. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. Securing America is straight ahead.
In cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Salih Houdiar. He is a man who has been elected to be the Prime Minister of the East Turkestan Government in Exile, and has been a champion for freedom in his country, and I think it's fair to say, in a lot of other places besides, and a man who has been warning about what's being done to freedom here in our own country. In part at the hands of, well, captured elites, the United Front Work Department of the Chinese Communist Party, which is the engine for capturing them, and sadly, even some inside our own government as well. All of this is part of the grist for the mill in our new book, which I'm very pleased to say is now available for pre-order, but will shortly be available actually to be in your hands as it is now in mine. It's called The Indictment, Prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and Friends for Crimes Against America, China, and the World. Salih, it's good to have you with us. I'm anxious to talk with you about how the people in East Turkestan are being criminally harmed by this Chinese Communist Party, which is, as I maintained in our book, a transnational criminal organization. And we'll talk as well about what they're doing in our own country that is evidence of criminality as well. But set the stage for us about what the people of East Turkestan, the Chinese call it Xinjiang, are being subjected to at the moment that is crimes against humanity of the first order.
Well, what the Chinese government is doing in East Turkestan is no doubt genocide and crimes against humanity. It's been recognized as such by the U.S. government and by the parliaments of over a dozen mostly Western countries. Since 2014, the Chinese government has been mass interning over 3 million Uyghurs, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and other Turkic peoples in concentration camps, using them as forced labor or slave labor in many cases, sterilizing hundreds of thousands of Uyghur and other Turkic women, harvesting the organs of those who that they deem need to be executed for, you know, whatever political crimes that the Chinese government is charging them.
There's quite a market for this because there's halal organs being sold. Is that right?
Yes, and because most of the people of East Turkestan, they're predominantly Muslim, so the Chinese government is, you know, profiting off of selling their organs, the so-called halal organs, to wealthy, Muslims from, you know, the Middle East and other parts of the world, which is
they are adhering to dietary restrictions.
Yeah, to the dietary restrictions of Islam, saying no pork, no alcohol, and so forth. But at the same time, you know, there are news reports, credible, you know, evidence that the Chinese government is forcing Uyghurs and other Turkic peoples to drink alcohol, to eat pork, especially during, you know, the holy month of Ramadan, which just ended. So it's very strange that the Muslim countries that are very well aware of what the Chinese government is doing is buying into this so-called halal organ scheme. But getting back to, you know, the atrocities, you know, don't end in East Turkestan. Even outside of East Turkestan, in, you know, countries as far away from East Turkestan as the United States, we are being, you know, targeted by China's agents, whether it's China's agents within our community or China's agents outside of our community, who, you know, have a lot of influence, apparently, even in the United States.
Talk a little bit about, first, before we get to what they're doing, this Chinese Communist Party enterprise known as the United Front Work Department. What is that, and what is its mission, and what's the evidence that it is at work here?
So the United Front Work Department is essentially a Chinese Communist Party intelligence agency. It was founded in the 1930s, right when the CCP was still being created, to influence and co-opt CCP groups, individuals, to align with the CCP's objectives and missions. And it has spread out, you know, globally to where they have, you know, members all across the world, and some of their, you know, external relations focuses on co-opting, you know, foreign governments, foreign organizations, to, you know, influence them to make policies that are not as detrimental to, you know, China's so-called core interests. And what are those core interests? Core interests in this case is East Turkestan, preventing East Turkestan independence, preventing Taiwan's independence, you know, preventing Tibetan independence. And you see this at work here in the United States, because even within our own community, even within the Uyghur community, unfortunately, there are some individuals who have deep connections with the CCP, who have a lot of influence here in the United States, who are actively working to, you know, prevent East Turkestan's independence. At the same time, you have, you know, the police stations that you hear about very commonly that have been in the news lately.
Full title. This is overseas Chinese police service centers, as they say. Carry on, but tell us about the kind of service that is being provided by those centers.
Well, I mean, it's a surveillance outpost in reality. It's not a service center. I mean, the only thing that they're servicing is the Chinese Communist Party, collecting information, collecting intelligence, in some cases even bringing in, you know, dissidents that they suspect are, you know, against the CCP or the PRC's line, and, quote, disciplining them or threatening them in these so-called, you know, service centers, which are intelligence, services.
Yeah, but give us a sense of how that operates. As I understand it, Sally, they are bringing people in who are not with the regime, and at least some of the time they are shown on a video screen relatives in China being interrogated or otherwise persecuted by authorities there. And in some cases, that's meant to make these dissidents toe the line. In some cases, maybe to work for the Chinese Communist Party. In other cases, force them to go back to China to a very unsavory fate. Is that your understanding of how this works?
Yes. And we've seen this quite very frequently in other countries, like in Turkey, where there's a larger Uyghur diaspora community, in the Central Asian republics, where, you know, they have deported them en masse. And the Chinese government says, oh, no, they voluntarily came back. It's just that we interviewed them before and they wanted to come back in these so-called, you know, server centers, which is, again, overseas intelligence, you know, stations that they, you know, bring in people and coerce them to come back.
Right. Often making them offers they can't refuse, as the Godfather used to say, right?
Yeah. I mean, if they say, if you don't come back, we're going to, you know, kill your parents, or we're going to kill your children, or whatever. And so they're like, if you come back, they'll live and, you know, you'll just serve a couple years in prison. And that's the deal, you know, that many people foolishly, you know, make, and you don't hear of them ever again.
Yeah. Sully, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about. It's my understanding that there is now, inside even the Biden administration, a bit more of an effort being made. Well, we've seen them close up the police service center in New York, for example, but also to punish those that they can identify as engaging in sort of repression in China or from China. What's the actual state of play there, as you understand it?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's not being, you know, addressed in an effective manner. I mean, there are a lot of individuals, you know, CCP individuals, officials that need to be, you know, prosecuted and charged, not just, you know, low-level officials. We're talking about, you know, Xi Jinping needs to be targeted as well. Just like how, you know, we're sanctioning a lot of senior Russian officials, the same thing needs to be done in terms of, you know, China and its leaders. But at the same time, we need to address United Front Works influence operations here in the United States, here within the halls of the U.S. Congress, here's within the halls of the U.S. government buildings. This is going to require a whole of government approach, to where we need to assess, you know, and be like, look, who's been compromised by China, you know, or who do we believe is compromised by China? What do we need to do? What information did they give, or what is going on? We need to, you know, look at all this and, you know, prosecute even, you know, those working in the United States, or some who might even be U.S., you know, officials to a various degree. We need to hold them accountable as well. If not, time is running out and China is just going to keep chipping away at our own, you know, democracy, chipping away at our own institutions, and using our own country to, you know, bring it down.
I couldn't agree more. And really, this is exactly the case that we're making in the indictment. These people need to be held accountable. And it's not just the Chinese communists, it's their friends as well. And those friends are people who have been among the captured elite. The purpose of these United Front Work Department operations, or they are people who, you know, have for whatever other reason seen fit to make common cause with the Chinese Communist Party. And against the backdrop of its horrific crimes against humanity, notably, but not exclusively, in East Turkestan, but also what it has been doing to wage unrestricted warfare against us, the war crimes that arise from all of that, they must be held accountable. You're absolutely right. And those involved in helping them do it must be prosecuted or forced to resign from leadership positions, impeached or otherwise, you know, disposed of in terms of the kind of role that they've been playing. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. America's bid to return human beings to the moon was just set back by the catastrophic loss during launch of the spacecraft Elon Musk's SpaceX built for the purpose. Worse yet, it appears increasingly possible that by the time we're ready to go back there, the Chinese Communist Party will have declared the place off limits and be able to enforce it. The Chinese Communists recently announced they are planning moon missions that will attempt to turn lunar dirt into bricks with which structures can be efficiently and inexpensively built. Inevitably, those will include fortifications. Chinese panoramic mapping of Mars and growing capabilities to neutralize other satellites offer further indications of the scope of what is at best Beijing's inherently dual-use space program. At worst, it is a fully militarized one with some civilian applications. Houston, we have a problem. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we're joined by a dear friend and very much admired comrade in the fight for the freedom of our country. In fact, she is the widow of a man who served as a very distinguished member of, well, among other things, board of our Center for Security Policy. But much more importantly, he was a leader in corporate America for decades, notably as a result of what he did to, well, build and then expand enormously the power and capability of an organization called CACI International. Her name is Jennifer London. His name was Dr. Jack London. The Dr. London who is with us has been very much, I think, keeping her husband's legacy alive with a marvelous book that she helped complete entitled Ever Vigilant, Leadership and Legacy, written by Dr. J. Philip London. And we're delighted to have a chance to visit with Jennifer again. We talked a bit about this a few weeks back, but Jennifer, there isn't a passing day that goes by that I'm not minded of what Jack stood for and what he would be making of what's going on in America today. Alas, without his leadership at the moment. And I just want to give you a chance to sort of level set for this audience again about what his attitude was towards the safety, the security, and the sovereignty of our country, and how desperately needed it is in corporate America at the moment.
Yes, I do think that Jack's emphasis on character would be for in the forefront of his thinking right now. His book, Ever Vigilant, Leadership and Legacy, by the executive chairman of CACI, is his memoir. He went to the Naval Academy, was a Navy aviator, retired as a captain, and grew a company, a government contracting company, that has supported some of our country's most important and critical national security needs. And so he was steeped in many years. I mean, he spent 50 years in the company, building it to a Fortune 500, $5.6 billion company, simply because he had a passion for supporting our country and its important national security needs. He did create a symposium looking at the asymmetric threats in our country. In 2010, he was interviewed in an article entitled The World is a Dangerous Place, in which he continued to, you know, beat the drum on the importance of recognizing that the world was increasingly becoming more dangerous. And I think that has only continued today. As we look around, I mean, it seems we've got a powder keg out there waiting to be.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me come back to the asymmetric warfare piece of this, because I think that's so critical. We're going to have a second block with you, fortunately. But just again, talking about character in leadership in corporate America seems to be sorely missing at the moment. And I just wonder what Jack might think, particularly of something that we've talked a lot about And in fact, I've written about in our own new book. It's entitled The Indictment. And it talks about how not only the Chinese Communist Party, but its friends have been engaged in crimes against America, China, and the world. And I remember visiting with Jack about this problem. He had me brief his board at a couple of points, as you know, I think you were there, talking about how the Chinese have taken advantage of leaders in not just corporate America and the business sector, the financial sector, but, you know, government, media, academia, and not least, of course, our culture. And I remember vividly that his attitude towards this, which was as always informed by his patriotism, his love of this country, and his deep appreciation, as you just said, of the fact that we are confronted by serious danger, serious threats, arguably the most serious of which is this Chinese Communist Party threat. How did he, you know, view the importance of corporate America supporting America in such a dangerous world?
Well, you know, Jack was a lifelong patriot. He was a true believer in our democratic republic. And he wrote a book on character, Character, the Ultimate Success Factor, in which he indicated that, you know, the short-term transient gains are not real success, that really it's, you know, having a culture of character, which he built in his company. He spoke to over 10,000 people around the country about the importance of character. He was very disturbed by the scandals by Enron and some of the other companies and, you know, asking himself, how could this have happened? And it often does start at the top. I think there is the people can be bought. The Chinese know that. I mean, the CCP know that. And that is a big part of their formula. They have their five-year plan, whatever their plan is, depending on what year it is. But they have a very, they have a proactive strategic plan. We seem to have a reactive plan. And there are a number of people out there that can be tempted by their affiliation with the easy, you know, the path of least resistance to get them, you know, economically secure or whatever. But I do think that money drives a lot of this. We can see this in what's happening in Africa with the way the CCP has bought its way into the country. It, you know, it's bought ports in Italy. It's even buying America. It's buying our farmland. And so when we go back to the subject of safety, security, and sovereignty, we have to look at the vice that I think China is putting us in so many ways. Look at our pharmaceutical drugs. Most of those come from China. Look at the illegal drugs. Those are coming from China. 200, an average of 200 people are dying in America every day. I mean, that's an epidemic from fentanyl. And so I feel that—
Well, it's chemical warfare, I would argue, being waged against by a hostile power.
China has 70 labs, and all of those are affiliated with the CCP. They are—
Jennifer, we have to take a short break. Hold on. This is a perfect lead into the asymmetric warfare conversation I want to have with you on the other side of a very short break. Jennifer London is in the house, Dr. Jennifer London, with her book that she is helping us keep in front of ourselves, Jack London's Wonderful Ever Vigilant. Welcome back. Dr. Jennifer London is in the house. We're talking with her, as we are privileged to do. And the inspiration of her late husband, Dr. J. Philip London, better known to his friends as Jack, a man of great intellect, great character, and great patriotism. And Jennifer, one of the things, as you mentioned, that Jack focused on, particularly during, you know, the last decade or more, was this idea that the United States' security, safety, and sovereignty, as you put it, was all being assaulted by asymmetric warfare being waged against it by a variety of hostile powers and, well, frankly, some enemies within. But especially, I think it became clearer and clearer that much of it was a function of the unrestricted warfare of the Chinese Communist Party. I wanted just to talk to you a little bit about that, because we're talking really about elite capture by mm-hmm. the CCP as an example of that unrestricted warfare. But more generally, as you look and as you channel Jack looking at the world today, talk a little bit about the extent to which, despite his best efforts, these symposia that you mentioned, we were very privileged at the Center for Security Policy to participate in many of them, notwithstanding those, you know, examples of asymmetric warfare, how we still seem not to be clearly attentive to it and the danger that it really does represent today.
Well, it's amazed me that it's taken a lot of people in America a long time to really understand the CCP's plan. I think they're waking up more so than a year ago, but it's been there. It's been out, you know. I mean, those in the know realize that this has been a long-term plan, and to become a world, you know, a dominant world power, and they've used a lot of means to get there. But the asymmetric approach is, as we mentioned, biological warfare, and China is one of 17 countries that has the capability of producing biological weapons, which can serve two purposes. One of which is, if it's unleashed on an enemy, can weaken them, making a military invasion easier. But it can also bring down another strategy from the CCP is to bring down their healthcare system. And so I think going back to your question about why we don't seem to be, I think, maybe focusing enough on this is we've got a lot of internal distractions. I mean, we've got a lot of party politics. And I'm concerned that we are losing sight of the fact that our enemy is not, it's not inside, it's outside. And our internal focus is too much on, I think, party politics, and we need to come together and recognize that there are threats from outside. I mean, I believe those threats are getting greater and greater over time. We also are, our military and most of the advanced military countries around the world are using autonomous methods of warfare, you know, electronic warfare. And one of the concerns by Jack was maintaining that human component in that system so that, because we know our enemies may not do that, but we want to keep the ethics and the ability to have the human component in there.
Amen. Yes. Let me just come back to this inside outside business, because I think you're absolutely right. There are a lot of distractions internal to the United States, to be sure. Not least going back to what you said before the break, you know, we are being subjected to both biological warfare, witness the COVID-19 pandemic, I believe, and chemical warfare, which I think is the best way to describe that fentanyl mm-hmm. attack yes. by the Chinese Communist Party. And make no bones about it, they're behind it for sure. But you also have this exploitation, I mean, fostering and fomenting and encouraging the fissures in our society. I personally think that this so-called CRT, critical race theory, diversity, inclusiveness, equity, and so on, is all basically cultural Marxism, and very much out of the playbook of, you know, the Chinese communists going back to Mao, where they understood, they used class warfare, of course, as you know, but racism is a theme that they and their, well, friends, as we put it in the book, are very much alive to and exploiting to divide us. So Jennifer, I mean, you've laid out, I think, the fact that we are highly susceptible to asymmetric warfare, whether from outside or from inside, and not terribly schooled as to how serious a danger that it poses to us. And again, I just think if Jack were with us, I'm pretty sure that one of the things that he would be focusing on at the moment is the extent to which all of these things now are directed at further reducing, as you put it, the safety, the security, and not least the sovereignty of the United States. And just, we got a minute left, but one of the things you and I've discussed in the past is this idea of using the World Health Organization, a communist Chinese owned and operated international organization, basically, to do exactly what you just said, to take down our public health system, certainly our options to have sovereignty over it. Your thoughts?
Well, I think I'm not sure that you know, our leadership understands the vulnerability that we have. As I mentioned earlier, you know, I believe China could pinch us in that vice in many different ways, as you mentioned, through the pharmaceuticals and so on. And there are fissures. I think that some people maybe don't quite recognize the danger, and some people, as we mentioned earlier, might be enticed into the idea that you know, there's economic gain by associating or affiliating. But I think what Jack would say, and he's mentioned this, there are videos of him online and in his book, and that is the importance of trust. We need to trust each other. We need to bring that idea back of recognizing we need to work together. We need to trust each other for the common good.
And we have to have a basis for that trust too, obviously. Jennifer London, this is such an important message. We look forward to having further conversations with you about trust and the need to be ever vigilant, as Jack London famously put it in his terrific book of that name.
Well,
God bless you,
you,
my dear. Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same again next time. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Go forth and multiply.